407. Raj Taylor driving you home this afternoon with assistance from none other than the star of morning radio, Jim McKinney. And Jim in master control, it's like having the trifecta back together. We need to find Jay. He's in the building someplace. We could actually have a reprise of the trifecta. 50 degrees in Kalamazoo, and going to have a warm, wet weekend, maybe even some thunder on Sunday. And we should, well, appreciate the warm temperatures, near 60 on Sunday, but don't get too excited. Snow in the forecast for Monday. 590 WKZO time is 4:08. And joining us now, Jeremy Martin. He's a senior scientist for clean cars at the Union of Concerned Scientists. Jeremy, good afternoon.
Hi, it's a pleasure to be here.
And when I saw the headline, EPA retreats on ethanol mandate, that inferred to me that something was amiss. But why we come to the Union of Concerned Scientists is to get a reality check. So give us that, if you would.
Sure, I'd be happy to. I mean, it's easy to see the questions about the future of our biofuels policy as just a black and white, you know, do we go with the oil industry or do we go with the corn ethanol industry? But the fact is, it's not that simple. You know, we definitely need cleaner alternatives to oil, and the renewable fuel standard, the policy that we're discussing, is, you know, is an important part of getting there. But, you know, some of the targets and goals in the renewable fuel standard were no longer realistic. And so what EPA has done today is made a proposal about how to, you know, make some adjustments and some course corrections so that we can keep this policy moving forward, but do it in a way that's realistic and, you know, works out over the long term.
One of the things that surprised me is that gas consumption in the U.S. is down fairly dramatically from when the ethanol mandate originated.
Yeah, that's right. And of course, you know, one of the big goals of policies like this renewable fuel standard is to cut our oil use. You know, because when we cut our oil use, then, of course, we cut all the problems that oil causes for our security and our economy and our climate. And, you know, because of more efficient vehicles, we've been able to cut we've been using less oil and using less gasoline. And so that's meant that, the balance of ethanol and gasoline actually shifted faster than expected. But basically, using less gasoline is good. It saves people money. You know, it's good for the environment. It's a real win-win. So there's nothing to, nothing to worry about there.
Oh yeah, I wasn't bemoaning the fact. I was pleasantly surprised.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, we're releasing less carbon dioxide into the atmosphere.
Mm-hmm.
A few weeks ago, there was a spat of commercials saying that ethanol damages your car, and then it appears the ethanol industry responded. What was that spat of advertising about? Do you know?
Sure. Well, you know, one of the, I mean, this gets pretty complicated, but you know, basically the gasoline that we're all buying today, for the most part, is what's called the E10. So it has about 10% ethanol blended in.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and for the most part, that's not controversial. You know, the cars are all, you know, designed to run on that fuel. And so that works out pretty well. What's happened is that, you know, as ethanol use has been increasing, and as gasoline demand has been dropping, you know, we've suddenly come to the point where we're using as a nation, we're using more than 10% ethanol. And so then the question is, the cars are designed for 10% ethanol. That's what the gas stations are distributing. So what are we going to do? How are we going to keep expanding? And, the ethanol industry has been interested in what's called E15, so 15% instead of 10%.
Mm-hmm.
And I think what this rule suggests, and you know, just sort of the reality of looking at what gas stations are selling now, suggests that that E15 path doesn't look like it's the road forward. And, I think actually, we've got more than 15 million of these flex-fuel vehicles on the road already, and these are cars that are designed to run on up to 85% ethanol.
Mm-hmm.
But up to now, they haven't really used much ethanol. And so, one of the sort of complicated details that EPA's got to figure out in striking this balance and making this policy work going forward is, how much, where are those E85 vehicles and how much fuel can they use? And so making sure that we keep moving forward, but that we do it in a way that makes sense given the infrastructure that we have and given the rate at which we can build some new infrastructure.
We're talking with Jeremy Martin from the Union of Concerned Scientists. He's a senior scientist focused on clean cars. Jeremy, Kalamazoo is a city, an urban area of about 250,000, and we have lost all but one of our E85 gas stations. Is that common in the rest of the country, or is Kalamazoo peculiar for some reason?
I can't speak to the details of Kalamazoo, but I will say that E85 hasn't been used much up to now, and that really reflects that it's easier for the oil companies and the gas stations and everybody to use E10 than E85. And so, when you had those two choices, everybody went with E10. So now that we're full up on E10, I think there is an opportunity for E85 to come back and to play a bigger role going forward. But obviously that's going to require having some gas stations, and that's the big bottleneck. And we need to make sure that that this policy moves forward, but that it does it in a way that's conscious of what the limitations are. And so, and really, the renewable fuel standard goals that are especially important to the Union of Concerned Scientists are not just exactly how much corn ethanol is used in 2014, but because corn ethanol has, a kind of a mixed record. What's really important is getting to the next generation, the advanced biofuels and the biofuels that are made from non-food resources, the so-called cellulosic or biomass-based fuels. And the RFS is a policy to get us there, but it's going to take quite a few years. And so, we need to get through the hurdles that we are facing in 2014 and sort of set a stable course, because that kind of stable course over a number of years is what's going to allow the investment in the next generation of biofuels that will really help us to, to cut oil use and to cut carbon emissions from transportation.
Sure. Why have other countries been so much more successful in using alternative fueled vehicles? Brazil, for example, runs a great number of vehicles on alcohol from sugarcane. Why haven't we made a quicker transition in this country, especially since we import a lot of the oil that we burn here, or at least have been until more recently?
Well, the comparison Brazil is the exception, and they really have moved very far in their use of a flexible fuel fleet and their ability to use a lot of alcohol in their vehicle supply. What's sort of interesting is that actually, the U.S. is actually a bigger producer of ethanol than Brazil. And actually, we have almost as many of the flex-fuel vehicles on the road as Brazil has. I was just speaking with an economist from Iowa State named Bruce Babcock about this. But our vehicles, for the most part, aren't using the fuel. And so it turns out, we've got the flex-fuel vehicles on the road. What we don't have is the gas stations, and we don't have attractive pricing. And so that's it starts to get complicated. But basically, in Brazil, you know, you don't get as many miles from a tank of ethanol as you get from a tank of gas. And
right.
So consumers make a calculation, and you know, they look at the different prices and they figure out if it's a better deal. You know, is the discount for the ethanol fuel make it a good deal? And, you know, I have great confidence that American consumers are as smart and as concerned about fuel costs as Brazilian consumers are. And so I think when the prices are good, you know, we're going to see E85 use increase. And that's, you know, that's poised to happen because of where this policy is going over the next few years.
Well, that makes sense, Jeremy. One of the stations that I'm thinking about is adjacent to a big Chevrolet dealership and GM, big in building flex fuel vehicles. And that station went to the expense of adding a new pump and tanks to sell E85, did it for about a year and a half or 2 years, and then switched it over to something else. And it has to be that they just weren't selling enough E85 to make that work. And so you're saying it's all based on pricing that passes a reasonableness test.
Mm-hmm. And really, that's one of the key questions that EPA is deciding, you know, right now, and that's at stake in this rulemaking is, you know, they need to make an estimate of, you know, what's reasonable, how much of the C85 can we expect to see sold. And it, you know, because of the way these policies work, their decision will impact pricing of E85. And so anyway, they're going to be working through the details in a public comment process. I guess this is an important point to make is, you know, we've seen a bunch of stories today saying, you know, EPA has made this decision, and what they've really done is they've made a proposal. And so there's going to be, you know, a couple months for they've proposed a range of possible approaches, and you know, all those stakeholders, including folks like me, but certainly people from the ethanol industry, people from the oil industry, people from the cellulosic and advanced biofuels industry, automobile makers, all sorts of people are going to be weighing in with, you know, what they think are the, you know, the right way to do this analysis and the right way to make a decision. And, you know, we're looking forward to that process and hopefully get a good outcome at the end that keeps us moving towards these low-carbon biofuels over the long term, you know, and addresses some of the challenges that we're facing in the short term.
Before I let you go, and we are running out of time, what is the delay in switching from corn to switchgrass to make ethanol? Why is it going to take a number of years, you mentioned?
Well, the first commercial cellulosic biofuel production facilities are operating right now, and that's just happened this year. And so that's, you know, that's really big news and really encouraging to people like me that watch this industry. So there's one in Florida, there's one in Mississippi, and there's three more under construction that should open in the next year, two in Iowa and one in Kansas. And so, you know, this fuel is real, and it's coming online now. But the fact is that the ethanol industry and even more the oil industry, these are really enormous industries. And so, you know, you don't just open one or two facilities and then there you're ready to go. It's going to take a period of several years to, you know, to expand to the level where, you know, where corn ethanol is or gasoline is. And, of course, you know, the corn ethanol industry or the gasoline industry, they've been around for, you know, actually for centuries, right? So, or a century or more.
Yeah.
And you know, so I think there may have been some excessive hype about, you know, how quickly we could do this. And certainly, you know, they also needed to raise money to build these facilities right in the 2008-2009 timeframe. So that slowed things down as well. But we're making progress now. And, you know, with a stable policy, we can keep making progress over the long term.
If people want to keep up on this issue and really understand some of these complex scientific issues, do you have any suggestions on where people could go, Jeremy?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, they should come to our website at that's the ucsusa.org, and we also have a blog, which is just blog.ucsusa.org. And so I'll be writing. I'm just drafting something now that I'll be writing next week, going into some more detail here, and have written a lot of things on this policy. And I have other colleagues writing about, you know, renewable energy and food and nuclear safety and all kinds of other interesting issues that your listeners may be interested in. So I encourage them to come to the website and learn more.
Appreciate your taking the time to talk with us.
Thank you very much for the opportunity.
Have a good one.
You too.
Jeremy Martin, senior scientist for clean cars at the Union of Concerned Scientists. And if you weren't able to get down that whole URL for the Union of Concerned Scientists, just do a Google. Union of Concerned Scientists. 590 WKZO time is 4:23.
You know, I put this in here on purpose.
Well, because it talks about days of the week and Friday being on your mind.
But it's The Cure.
Yeah.
I love The Cure.
Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, that was why.
Well, that and plus it's Friday, I'm in love. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay. That makes sense.
I went out and added the video to one of my YouTube lists.
Oh.
So I've been discovering new music, sort of, on Sirius XM because I have that. And so the 80s, they'll do like chunks of countdowns from like this week in 1984, 1986. So guess what the song I got to hear the other day?
What?
Tarzan Boy by Baltimora.
Never heard that.
Oh, it's a great song. I'll have to put the music in here and you'll have to try it out and then you can go, what are you out of your mind?
I don't, I've never been, was that a top 40?
Yeah, it was. It was a one hit wonder. So.
Yeah. I'm not a big top 40 sort of.
Oh, that's good. The 80s were all good. Even when they were bad, they were good.
Well, that was the era of disco.
No, 70s was disco.
Okay, okay.
80s was bands like Flock of Seagulls. And
I like Flock of Seagulls.
You know, on Kajagoogoo and, you know.
I'm not familiar with this Kajagoogoo you refer to. Who is Kajagoogoo?
They were a one-hit wonder that did a song called Too Shy.
Kajagoogoo.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. So. Now, the Goo Goo Dolls, I've heard of.
Yes.
But
I'll put some. Don't I have Goo Goo Dolls in there for you?
I don't know.
I thought I did.
But never heard of this Kajagoogoo.
Kajagoogoo. K-A-J-A.
Kaja.
G-O-O-G-O-O.
Okay.
Yes.
That's Go-Go, not Goo Goo.
No, not the Go-Go's. They were an 80s band, too.
Cute, too. You're confusing me.
That's my job.
Yeah. You know all this music that I have never heard of in my life.
Am I going to have to come in here and do, like, music 101 with you?
Yeah.
Okay.
You know, you want to teach a class in the history of rock and roll.
I tried once.
You've forgotten more about it than...
I tried once.
Most of us mere mortals know.
They didn't want me.
Hey, did you hear about this 19-year-old girl that was shot at the front door of a house over in Wayne County?
I read the story. I wasn't real familiar with what was going on.
Well, apparently she...
Was she the one who was inebriated and knocked on the wrong door and the guy shot her in the face, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. He's been indicted for murder.
Okay, well, I could see that.
When you accidentally shoot somebody through the front door of your house, it's hard to argue you felt at risk seeing this 19-year-old girl was locked outside of that door and was not making any attempt to break through the door. Her only attempt was knocking on said door. and the charge, murder in the second degree, carries a term of up to life in prison. Manslaughter with a maximum of 15 years is also possible. And possession of a firearm during the commission of a felony. That carries a term of 2 additional years. In the 2 weeks since Renisha McBride was shot outside the Dearborn Heights home, protests have escalated around the country, bringing comparisons to Trayvon Martin. And so let this be a warning to you. Do not carry a weapon to your front door. And he was apparently juggling it.
Yeah, that's a good thing to do.
He said it just went off accidentally.
Well, now his lawyer says the shooting was justified. So how can you justify a shooting if you're doing a circus act with your weapon?
Yeah, and you're on the outside of a locked front door, with the only activity being the young lady on the porch.
I'm Pam Coulter.
Raj Taylor taking you home this afternoon. The WKZO.com AccuWeather forecast brought to you by Lake Michigan Credit Union, the best place for your money. Learn more at lmcu.org. And joining me now is Mark Phelan, the auto critic for the Detroit Free Press. Mark, how you doing this afternoon?
How about you?
Fat and sassy. our ace morning person is in master control this afternoon. And in talking about the fact that you were coming on, he wondered, and now I do too, have you ever been pulled over by the police while testing one of these cars you test so ably?
It happens occasionally. I mean, you try to pay attention to the speed limit, but I think all of us occasionally miss a sign or underestimate how quickly we're going. So, yes.
Okay. That I would think there would be a risk in that because frequently it is high-performance cars you're test driving. And how do you test drive a high-performance car without making it perform?
Well, you can't ever do anything that would be unsafe on the public roads.
Right.
That's the prime directive. And you can get a good sense for a vehicle's acceleration and cornering without exceeding any of the legal limits. Something that I find interesting is that if you find a nice, really tight set of curves, you can do a pretty good job. You can get a very good feel for where the limits for a car would be without ever driving at an unsafe speed. So, I mean, if you have nice, twisty, country roads at, 30 or 40 miles an hour, you can get a real good feel for how does this car compare to others. And it's something that you develop a sense for over time, because I've driven many of these cars also on closed tracks with, racetracks and closed road courses. So that helps me figure out what translates from a countryside curve to the sort of curves that you would get in a closed course. It's a matter of time and experience, really, but you never want to do anything that would put anybody at risk.
Well said, just in the off chance your boss is listening.
Thank you.
Well stated, my friend. While we're speaking of high-performance cars, this goes back a week or so, but you took some Chrysler products out for a ride, the Dart, the Challenger, and the Charger. I have read some good things about the Dart. What was your thoughts as you test drove those cars?
I like the Dart a lot. The model that I wrote about last week was actually a show car that they had done especially for a show that specializes in custom vehicles in Las Vegas. Mm-hmm. So they weren't letting anybody drive that specific one. But I think the Dart's a very nice little car. It's got a ton of room, a nice selection of engines, good fuel economy. I think it's a really pleasant and appealing compact sedan.
Mm-hmm. Is this Chrysler's comeback car? Is this the car that is finally going to get Mopars in driveways again?
That's what they hope for. They're trying very hard. The show in Las Vegas is a great place to showcase new performance and cosmetic things from Mopar and other brands that specialize in customization. And what they were trying to do was show people a Charger and a Challenger that had a bunch of new Mopar parts, and also showcase a Dart alongside it so that people would get the idea that the Dart is a car that you can customize and do performance versions of. And it's going to be very interesting to see. I think that it was an extremely effective package. They call it the Scat package.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, it includes performance and cosmetic things, and there are three different levels of it. And the idea of the Scat Pack name goes way back to the late 60s and early 70s when Dodge was one of the rulers among muscle cars, and they're trying to regain some of that cachet.
Uh-huh. The Shaker model is one that puzzled me. Why is seeing the engine shaking through the hood attractive?
I have to say that I'm with you on that one.
Oh, okay.
I've never really gotten it. And if you cut a hole in the hood, you're, of course, inviting a lot more engine noise out into the world with you.
Yeah.
But there are people who don't mind that. And there are people who like just revving the engine and watching that exposed part of the engine that's sticking up through the hole in the hood shake a little bit back and forth. That's where the name comes from.
Oh, yeah.
I'll be real interested to see if there is an appetite for that now that we're in 2013. But even if there's not, they've got several other performance packages that should get them some buyers. But it'd be very interesting if the old Shaker idea did catch on, and you even saw it on little cars like the Dodge Dart, the Ford Focus. I would really kind of love to see somebody do that to a compact car, just because, as far as I know, it hasn't been done.
Yeah. When you took the Dart out for a ride, it was just a production Dart, correct?
Yes.
And is it going to get people excited?
Well, it hasn't yet, which is, frankly, I think a bit of a surprise, because it's a very nice car. I think part of the problem is that Chrysler hasn't built a very nice compact car in kind of a long time. I mean, the PT Cruiser was the last one that really made a splash, and it was new back in 1999 or something like that.
Yeah.
So they've kind of fallen off a lot of shopping lists, and I think that it takes something really special to get you back onto the shopping list. My guess is that the Dart is more of a first step towards reestablishing their credibility.
Okay.
It got off to kind of a slow start in sales, but it's selling quite well now. And as I say, I think it's a good-looking vehicle. It's got a ton of really nice features, and good performance, good fuel economy. So it certainly deserves to be considered if people are looking for a compact car, and that's not something that Chrysler could say 2 years ago.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's a step in the right direction for sure.
Yeah.
The new Jeep Cherokee that they're just introducing might be the vehicle that really grabs people's attention.
Okay.
Out of all of the new stuff that Chrysler's got coming.
Does Chrysler do more with aftermarket products? The products you mentioned that you can use to customize your vehicle. When I drive a Scion, and they prided themselves at first that you could really make this into your car. Is Chrysler doing more of that than GM and Ford?
They want to, and the Mopar name that they use for all of their aftermarket parts is a well-established name, so they've got that going for them. And they've got the Jeep brand, which people have been customizing forever. So I don't know if I could say that they do more than GM or Ford, because each of them have got some vehicles that customize well, too, Ford, the Mustang in particular. But Chrysler is certainly, you know, among the leaders in that, and with Jeep and with, you know, Ram pickups, they've got a ton of customization work. What they're trying to do now is get people to be as excited about customizing the passenger cars as they are about, you know, making a unique statement with a Jeep or a pickup. Mm-hmm. That's sort of the next frontier for them.
Yeah, yeah.
And Scion did that brilliantly, by the way. It was one of the best things about that brand when it first debuted, how many different customization kits they had.
Oh, yeah. Interior lighting, the whole nine yards. My car doesn't have any of those, but it was possible. Before I let you go, a couple of weeks ago we talked and you'd taken a new Corvette for a ride. And this week you took a 2014 Jaguar F-Type with their V8 in it. How does it compare to the Vette?
I have to say, I enjoyed a number of things about the Jaguar F-Type, but in the final analysis, it made me appreciate how good the Corvette is even more than I had before.
Ah.
Because I thought that, you know, the Jag, it's pretty, it's fast, but the one I was driving, you know, cost $102,000, and it was lacking some features that you could have gotten in a Corvette for $30,000 less, and it's not like it was vastly faster or prettier or anything than that. Than the Vette. I mean, honestly, I ended up being even more impressed by the Vette than I was before, after I had tested the Jaguar as well. It was very interesting to me.
Mark, one of the reasons I always enjoy talking with you is I come away impressed with the ability to build automobiles in this country, and that we do build competitive automobiles, world-class automobiles. And try as we might, Michigan is still very much dependent on the auto industry. And you give me a sense of optimism that the big three really are going to be long-term players.
Well, I'm glad to hear that, because I think the cars and trucks that they're building these days justify that.
Yeah.
There's really never been as good a bunch of products from Ford, GM, and Chrysler as there are today.
Yeah. Appreciate your taking time to chat with us. Mark, if people want to find your columns in the Free Press, how would they do that?
Oh, well, you can always go to freep.com. Short for Free Press, freep.com, and look for me there under autos or columns, and I should be easy to find.
Thank you, Mark. Have yourself a good weekend. Thanks for joining us.
You too. Thank you, Roger.
Bye, Mark. 590 WKZO time is 4:51, 49 degrees now. That's the average normal high temperature. So today, just average. We'll give you a complete look at your weekend weather right after a news update on 590 WKZO.
Is this the song that you really like?
Gonna sit down in the kitchen. Oh, yeah. For several reasons.
Yeah, I bet.
Mostly, we play it at this time on Friday afternoon. I just have tomorrow morning in front of me, and then I have the weekend.
Yes.
And that's always a good thing.
Yeah, we'll play that song in a minute or two.
Yeah, yeah. One more Friday song. Well, sadly, today was the day we began killing wolves in the UP. And even sadder, read a publication on the internet that receives wide distribution. And it had a quote from a person from Kalamazoo.
Yeah.
We're mentioned in the article, Bob Graves, his name, from, as they say, a place called Kalamazoo. And his quote is interesting to me.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, I'll take the pelt, but that's not why. It's not being here to put a trophy on the wall. It's the experience to hunt a majestic animal, a beautiful animal. What he left out was killing it. There's this majestic, beautiful animal that he's following in the woods. And the one thing that comes to his mind to do in that situation is kill something. Has this man never heard of a camera?
Well, you know, the thing is, Roger, though, when you're dealing with a hunter, you have to understand that part of the thrill of everything is the hunt and hunting an animal that is not helpless. So when it comes to a wolf or comes to a bear or comes to an elk or comes to a deer or whatever, they can all be considered majestic the way that they are.
Yeah.
But that's part of the, I believe, the hunting mindset is matching wits with an animal that is majestic and that is intelligent and whatnot.
And then killing it.
Well, that's part of, yeah, hunting involves killing something, you know. It's like,
but if this was for eating, that would be different. I am pro deer hunting, especially with donating the food production to people who were going hungry.
Mm-hmm.
And Lord knows we have more deer than we know what to do with down here. Wolves are an endangered species that haven't recovered from the last time we hunted them to extirpation in the state. And this guy, it's beautiful, a majestic, beautiful animal. I want to kill it.
Kalamazoo's news, weather, and traffic station is 590 WKZO. Kalamazoo.